Portland.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. KABU's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kabu.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, legendary consumer advocate and human rights champion Ralph Nader speaks out about the expanding U.S. armed genocide in Gaza, including forced starvation as a frontline weapon of war. We'll also speak with Ralph about his new book, Civil Disrespect, A Civil Self-Respect, an inspiring exploration of democracy that separates the concept of a citizen into various roles, providing a clarifying mission to all who read this call to action and civil participation. I'm Dennis Bernstein, all this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And yes, the name of that book is Civil Self-Respect. Ralph Nader, welcome back to Flashpoint Center again to have you with us on Pacifica Radio.
Thank you, Dennis.
Well, thank you. We appreciate you joining us. We really wanted to talk to you about several different things, but I want to start with Gaza. Maybe I can ask you the question this way. How far have we come since the exploding Pintos? Now we're exploding two-year-olds with weapons that are, I guess, much more sophisticated, and they're meant to blow people up. Give us your response to what we're seeing on the ground now.
What we're seeing is a Palestinian Holocaust. A huge death undercount has been perpetrated by Hamas because it doesn't want to, you know, arouse its people if they can't protect them. Didn't provide shelters, no bomb shelters, air raid shelters, safe rooms where the Israelis have. And Netanyahu likes an undercount for his own purposes as well. So that they're using the figure, the media, 58,000. It's over 500,000. You can't have a tiny enclave the size geographically of Philadelphia with 2.3 million people, have 170,000 tons of bombs, all kinds of artillery, sniper fire, denial of food, water, medicine, health care, all kinds of infectious diseases, destroying homes, apartment buildings, markets, religious institutions, educational institutions, just anything that stands, anything that moves. 75% of Gaza is now completely destroyed. And they're trying to persuade us that there are still 97 out of every 100 Gazans alive. What are they made of, steel and asbestos? If you have an estimate of 500,000, which you can piece together by experts in disaster casualties who have looked at this, we wouldn't even be having this conversation if Biden and Trump had the guts to tell Netanyahu to let U.S. reporters into Gaza. They're prohibited, along with even Israeli reporters, so they can do the dirty work of genocide and mass murder, minimally detected. At any rate, you can't have all of this devastation. And there are no homes, you know. All the homes are destroyed. The best that people have are tents. They keep being pushed in mass evacuations, whipsawed back and forth, starved, no potable water, the water is either salt water, which kills you eventually, or it's contaminated and leads to deadly dysentery. 5,000 babies born into the rubble every month. You have 45,000 diabetics without any insulin. You have 80,000 cancer patients before October 7th. They don't have any medicine. So why is it important? Number one, it's respectful of Palestinians. If the shoe was on the other foot, you think anybody in the mass media would tolerate a vast undercount of casualties on the Israeli side? Of course not. There's either an indifference among the New York Times, Washington Post, AP, Wall Street Journal, you name it, or it's prejudice, it's bigotry. They don't have any problem estimating deaths in Ukraine, injuries in Ukraine, but somehow they like the Hamas undercount. Now, if you had a real count, Dennis, say 500,000 or more, and a lot of the American doctors back from Gaza will attest to this, you will have a much more intense political, diplomatic, and civic efforts to stop the fighting, to stop the killing, to get a ceasefire, let the humanitarian trucks that are piled up, ready to go with food, medicine, water, hospital supplies. There's enough food to feed all the Gazans for 3 months in warehouses only a few miles away, blocked by the Israeli military. So here we have a mega terrorist, Netanyahu, being aided and abetted by the coward, Donald Trump. Trump's afraid of Netanyahu, and especially his domestic Israeli government can do no wrong lobby in the U.S. So he's weaponizing it the way Biden did, and he's covering up, and he's buying time. You know, on July 3rd, he told reporters when Netanyahu visits the White House, he's going to be, quote, very firm with him, quote, and he expects to cease fire in about a week. Well, it's another one of his buying time fantasies, manipulations. He's doing nothing. The State Department has all kinds of information on the true death and casualty count. And the doctors back from Gaza, as I mentioned, they say that the people who survived, he says almost all of them are either sick, injured, or dying. You can't have this most massive, intense, day after day since October 23, bombardment, artillery, destruction, snipers, and denial of the essentials of human life, with babies being snipered. They even snipered incubators, and they just attacked Pope Francis's Catholic Church in Gaza. There's nothing off limits. They've destroyed all the universities, 90% of the schools. They've destroyed the water mains, the electricity. They've even destroyed small agricultural areas, plowed them under, and destroyed cemeteries. So this is what the American people are paying for. This is what is being done in the names of the American people. And so the growing resistance here, public opinion polls are turning against the Israeli mass slaughter like nobody expected 2 years ago. But it's not affecting Congress, Dennis. Congress like a cocoon in the pocket of AIPAC, with only a few dozen exceptions. And until Congress begins to stand up to its constitutional responsibilities and its holding the president accountable and requiring that he obey 5 or 6 federal statutes that he's disobeying because he's sending unconditional weapons to Israel, such as a ban on weapons to foreign countries who violate human rights. Until that happens, our country's going to be a co-belligerency. And why should we always think there's never going to be any retaliation? You imagine if they were doing this to us, you don't think we'd retaliate? And you have now drone warfare, inexpensive drones that can be built in garages with deadly effect, as the press has been pointing out. And that's all we need to have Trump turn us into a complete, total police state, terrorist, fascist dictatorship, is to have an attack here in terms of retaliation.
Ralph, one of the most cynical parts of this at the moment is that this new so-called food distribution system where you put out a few scraps of food and when people come to pick them up, you shoot them. Your thoughts on that, on this new system of feeding Gazans?
Well, this is a shadowy group. It's called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Can you imagine? It has Israeli and U.S. components, including private security, including consulting firms who want to make a profit off this. And it's extremely shadowy. And what they do, for example, one pattern is they open up at 4 a.m. and these poor people are struggling, starving, with their hands outstretched for a sack of flour or something. And if they don't get it in 10 minutes, the shooting starts. And so they're killing 80 to 120 innocents a day. Cold-blooded murder. The world has never seen anything like this. Let me tell you, when the Nazis were perpetrating the Jewish Holocaust, they had to contend with the Allies. They had to contend with the Russian and U.S., French, English armed forces who were hell-bent on toppling Hitler and freeing the death camps. Now you have a Palestinian Holocaust where the U.S. armed forces are supporting the Israeli genocide with intelligence and with all kinds of actual military support, not just sending weapons over there. And so what we're seeing is a level of savagery, depravity, that in order for one guy to keep his job as prime minister and not lose a couple extreme religious parties who could collapse his coalition. By the way, you know, everybody seems to forget, how did this all happen? How did the most sophisticated, multi-tiered border security in the world between Israel and Gaza suddenly collapse on October 7th? How come the 19, 20-year-old Israeli soldiers, women, spotters, when they kept saying to Netanyahu's people, there's this activity there, they're training there, these guys are fighters, how did they ignore it? Well, it could be a blunder, which of course catapulted Israel to total dominance in the Middle East, and increasingly control of U.S. budgets. Now it's billion, not just $3-4 billion, it was tens of billions of dollars, and suppressing free speech and civil liberties, such as on campuses from Berkeley to Harvard, this fake assertion of anti-Semitism at Harvard and Columbia. David Coles, probably the leading civil liberties expert in the United States, Georgetown law professor, said that there hasn't been a single documented case in Columbia and Harvard of anti-Semitism. And if you read the two reports that the president of Harvard wrote, he couldn't find a single case. He just found people anonymously saying they feel uncomfortable. Well, you know, German-American and Italian-American students felt uncomfortable World War II. Arab-Americans after 9/11. All this is fake. And all this starts with Netanyahu's blunder. Now, was it really a blunder? And that's why he has opposed an official investigation against his critics. If it wasn't for the Gaza situation, he'd be widely despised because he tried to dismantle the independence of the judiciary. He's under prosecution for corruption by Israeli prosecutors. And generally, he was very unpopular. So he found an enemy, opened the borders. It's hard to believe that it was a blunder. Just too many things went wrong at the same time. Too many human intelligence spies, informants. Are they trying to persuade the American people, the Israeli regime, that they didn't know about 500 miles underground, the most elaborate tunnel system in modern world? They didn't know about it. They have spies, informants. They know where extended families have dinner with one another. They have their DNA. They pulled a fast one on the media here and the American people. and we got to expose it.
Yes, we do. And speaking of the media, we're speaking with Ralph Nader, by the way. Speaking of the media, something over 230 journalists have been gunned down. How important is it to have a free press? And what are we missing because of those missing journalists?
Well, we're missing the truth. I've talked to a lot of reporters, New York Times, Washington Post, others, and I say, why aren't you reporting the real death count? Well, so all we have to go on is the Hamas numbers. No, you don't only have to go to the Hamas numbers. Why suddenly you give Hamas credibility on something like that? You know how to piece it together. There are all kinds of UN humanitarian groups, nonprofit groups like Save the Children, Doctors Without Borders. You have academics, University of Edinburgh, all experts on disaster casualties, Brown University, Johns Hopkins. You have credible estimates by Lancet, the prestigious British medical journal. You know, they were at 200,000 over a year ago, and they said it was conservative. So that's why we need KPFA. We need Pacifica Radio. Even Amy Goodman's swallowing the Hamas figures. She now adds, and there are thousands under the rubble. And I say, Amy, week after week, month after month, you're not getting out to the public the real death toll, which would change the whole political, diplomatic, and civic dynamics all over the world. 500,000 dead out of 2.3 million means that 3 out of 4 are still alive, however sick and injured. And that's not an exaggeration, if I ever saw one. I mean, how can anybody survive this? 500,000, Dennis, is more than the number of U.S. soldiers killed in World War II, Pacific and European theaters. It's twice as many as died in Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and Dresden, all in a tiny area the size geographically of Philadelphia, with 2.3 million people.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Ralph Nader, and we're talking about the expanding genocide in Gaza and against Palestine, funded, aided, armed by the United States government. It is extraordinary, Ralph, that we continue to ship over these 2,000 and 5,000 pound bombs to drop on 2-year-olds. Would you call this? It does feel now as it's a war. It's turned into a war against children.
It is. Well, you know, a prominent Israeli politician accused Netanyahu a few weeks ago of killing babies as a hobby. It's the phrase he used, killing babies as a hobby. Let's not forget, there are 16 courageous Israeli human rights groups who have been demanding the truth, who have been demanding that Biden and Trump stop the catastrophe. These are former reservists, rabbis against human rights. Just recently, a full-page ad in the New York Times Magazine of 700 U.S. rabbis demanding food aid to Gaza and a cessation of the violence, and they've had 25,000 Jewish Americans sign already, and they want more. It's interesting how this doesn't make a feature in the New York Times or Post. They haven't had any features on the human rights groups. They haven't had a feature on Veterans for Peace, which I belong to, a wonderful group with 100 chapters all over the U.S. Demonstrations, marches, even nonviolent civil disobedience at munitions factories, sending death-dealing weapons to Netanyahu. No feature on that. So you might want to consider a feature. Mike Ferner is a great leader of Veterans for Peace. He just got the Callaway Award for moral courage. You might want to have him on. But we're getting a blackout on all this, except for Amy Goodman. She puts some people on like that. But by and large, we're seeing a level of moral indifference that is historic. It's going to come back mercilessly in the verdict of history. here mercilessly. There are a lot of liberal Jewish American civic advocates who still haven't spoken out. If you can't speak out when you have 700 rabbis on your side, when you have the wonderful Israeli human rights groups, when you have Haaretz, the newspaper, what's left of your moral stature here? How are you going to live with yourself after it's over?
Would you call this, what kind of censorship would you call this, where you've got, say, the New York Times making a decision that you can't be using words like genocide or ethnic cleansing? You think any statement like that, any decision like that would be justified? Can you, why would you exclude such words? Do you consider this a genocide?
Well, of course, the leading experts in the world on genocide, the professor at Brown University, Bartov, he was in the Israeli army for 4 years. He said, I know genocide when I see it. This is genocide. And he said most genocide scholars all over the world have said it's genocide. But it's worse than genocide, Dennis. It's now moving into omnicide. Genocide means an intent and activity to destroy people as a group, identifiable group. Well, now it's obliteration. It's now moving to omnicide for the people in Gaza. It had nothing to do with October 7th. This October 7th is right in the back of Netanyahu. Blocking official investigation, censoring, harassing people. He's like Trump. You know, he threatens people, harasses them in Israel, try to shut them up, cut the ground from under them in terms of their economic or other opportunities. And Trump's going along with this completely. Trump's a coward. He's afraid of Netanyahu. And he's just allowing this to happen. If you saw the way he sat with Netanyahu, he just had his hands folded in the White House the other day.
Yes.
He was sort of nodding when Netanyahu declared a freedom of choice for Israeli, for Palestinians to emigrate to some country undefined to receive them. And he was nodding. He hasn't lifted a finger. He's the one person in the world with one call could stop the killing and open up the humanitarian aid trucks, which, by the way, U.S. taxpayers are paid for.
And there is certainly a lot of money being made by these weapons manufacturers. It seems that one of their main clients are the Israelis in the context of slaughtering the population. And it is extraordinary how they continue to move hundreds of thousands, millions of people back and forth across the Gaza Strip. I've never quite seen anything like that. Until what? Until they can push them out or kill them all.
That's exactly what it is, what's going on here. It's the most deliberate, omnicidal program you can imagine. I mean, snipers killing people with their hands outstretched or a little flower or some piece of food is being handed out to them. And most of them can't even get to the feeding sites because they're miles and miles. They can't walk. The roads are gutted. There's no transportation. They can't. The children are dying. The hospitals are all broken and blown up. Blood everywhere. Corpses everywhere. Dogs feeding on dead Palestinians on the ground. It's just. I really never thought that enough Americans would care less. There are a lot of them. There are hundreds of thousands protesting, obviously, and all credit to them. And Doctors Against Genocide are up on Capitol Hill constantly. The doctors back from, and the health workers back from Gaza have written public letters to Biden and other officials. They've documented all kinds of atrocities that they actually visited. They have x-rays of seven-month-old babies with bullets in their skull. That's sniper work. And they have stories like Israeli soldiers high-five each other when they kill a pregnant woman, saying it's two for one. It's just, all this will start to come out. Already the soldiers, some of them have moral trauma themselves from what they've been told to do. No rules of engagement with the Geneva Conventions or anything, just kill anything. Anything that moves and blow up anything that stands. They're starting to talk now when they go back to Israel. And it's going to be much more of that. As Ehud Barak and others said in an open letter to Congress demanding that they disinvite Netanyahu last year, which the Congress didn't do, said that Netanyahu's destroying Israel. He's destroying the whole consensus, the whole rule of law, the democratic institutions, turn it into one-man rule like Trump is doing to the U.S. And but what we've got to worry about is that these weapon manufacturers, Dennis, they're using modern weapons to test, and the Israelis use them to test on Palestinians in the most gruesome and grotesque manner, and then they report back to, like, Lockheed Martin or Raytheon or other, Boeing or others. So there is a profiteering aspect to this as well, but overwhelmingly it's on the shoulders of the political leadership of the U.S., Congress, and the White House. The courts, of course, just don't pay any attention to foreign policy like that. They consider it off-limits to judicial determination.
I've heard this phrase, comparison kills, but I do want to ask you, many people are comparing what we're seeing with the forced starvation, that this is on the ground, it's starting to look like the Nazi concentration camps. Is that far-reaching? Is that an overstatement?
You mean in this country with the migrants?
No, I'm talking about the starving people in Gaza, where we're starting to see bone skeletons. People are falling down on the streets. They're dying in the streets from hunger.
Oh, of course. There are differences, of course. You know, Hitler killed 6 million Jews and 15 million Slavs, Slavic people, and so on. But, you know, give the Israeli regime time. There's nothing that they will decide not to kill. Look at their bombing, invading southern Syria regularly. They're everywhere, all over the Middle East. Now, the difference is this. In the Jewish Holocaust, there were Jews who were able to flee. And we've seen that many times, fled Nazism. They can't flee in Gaza. It's a complete open-air prison. They can't flee. They're trapped and fired on constantly, bombarded, and denied food, water, medicine, electricity, fuel, no hospitals, clinics blown up, schools destroyed, everything. So that's one difference. Another difference is that Hitler had to contend with the U.S. and Russian military that was out to overthrow him. Netanyahu doesn't have to contend with the U.S. The U.S. is helping him, weaponizing him, covering him in the U.N., political cover, punishing any allies. Already, you have 21 European countries plus Canada, Australia, and Japan denouncing Netanyahu, saying, stop the starvation. Open the humanitarian gates with these trucks and cease fire. And look how long it took for that to happen. That's because the U.S. was putting pressure against their own allies to shut up. The only one that succeeded was Germany, which is disgracing itself.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Ralph Nader. And Ralph, I want to ask you about your new book, because it's about what citizens need to do to really be citizens, how people should be acting, or tell us, talk to us a little bit about civil self-respect. Tell us why you wrote the book now and what it has to do with all this.
Well, this is a very fundamental little book. it started when I'd be speaking years ago at audiences, and once in a while, someone would come up and say, Ralph, I know I'm a nobody, but I got to ask you a question. And I say, wait a minute. Time out. You say you're a nobody? What do you mean you're a nobody? What kind of work do you do? Well, they say, you know, I'm an electrician or a teacher or a healthcare worker or whatever. I said, you pay taxes? Yeah, well, you're a taxpayer too. I said, do you shop at all? Yeah, of course. Well, that means you're a consumer shopper. Have you been in the military? Well, sometimes you say yes. Well, that's another role you played as a veteran. Do you vote? Yeah. Well, that's another role you play. How can you say you're nobody? Are you a philanthropist? Oh, no, I don't have the money for that. Sure you do. Low-income people give a higher proportion of money to charity at churches and other Salvation Army, whatever, than the rich do. So you're a philanthropist as well. So how can you say you're a nobody? So I figured out that I had a table of contents which started out with all these roles so that nobody would ever say again they're a nobody. They say, I, the citizen, I, the voter, I, the taxpayer, I, the worker, I, the consumer shopper, I, the parent, I, the veteran, I, the philanthropist. And I show how easy it is, Dennis, to add a civic dimension to the daily routine. So if when you're a shopper, you become a little more informed about nutrition. You become a source of information for your neighborhood about food that's good for you. You might want to object to the Food and Drug Administration. Nothing onerous. The same with if your workplace, you know what the labor rights are and the fair labor standards are. So when the major employee pushes you around, you know what your rights are and you can reassert them. That's the civic dimension to being a worker. If you're a veteran, veterans have moral authority in this country, and Veterans for Peace have demonstrated that. Well, you know, when you come back, you know things. You've seen things. You've made up your mind on things about these wars of aggression that we've turned into a U.S. empire. And you can be an active person in your community, and the people listen to you because you're a veteran. Taxpayer. You say, well, you're a taxpayer, sure, but most people just want lower taxes, for example. Yeah, but there's a lot more to being a taxpayer. One is start demanding that you get your tax dollars returned to your community instead of to the military industrial complex and hundreds of billions of dollars of corporate welfare subsidies, handouts, giveaways. You should tax dollars go back to rebuild the community, the public services, the public works, the schools, the mass transit, the roads, buildings, all the things that are crumbling, pollution control systems, parks. The reason why there's less of a tax revolt in Europe, Western Europe, over the years, Dennis, is because the money comes back to them. They get universal health insurance for their taxes. They get good pensions for their taxes. They get a month paid vacation for their taxes. They get good public transit for their taxes. They get all kinds of things. And that's why there isn't that kind of vitriolic hatred of taxes that you see in this country. And another thing taxpayers can do is say, why is Trump cutting the IRS budget? So all the rich people and all the big corporations can escape being audited, losing tens of billions of dollars, as the press has been reported every year. Here's how small. They're firing 25,000 IRS people out of 95,000. Good luck on how long you stay on the phone or trying to get a response. But even more significant is they're getting rid of the skilled auditors who know all the tricks of tax evasion and overseas escapes and deferred taxation gimmicks and so forth. And who now, taxpayers who pay their taxes, especially if they're withheld every week, they can have a civic dimension and say, hey, look, you know, we're not just interested in the tax rate. We're interested in these undertaxed, super rich, and corporations who are moving towards zero taxation. Half of the big profitable corporations pay no federal income tax last year. And a lot of them pay just 2, 3, 4, 5%, so that they can really put the pressure on members of Congress. All this is just routine. You know, it could be just part of going through life every day, not getting pushed around, disrespected, undermined, forgotten about. It's not a pleasant way to be going through daily life powerless, feeling like you don't matter and you don't count. People can get a copy of this book, even autographed, by just going to nader.org. You'll get it right away.
Go to nader.org. Or they can get, they'll be able to get it today here as well. We're gonna be talking about that, Ralph. We're gonna let you go, and we appreciate the expanded interview and your focus on what's happening in Gaza. I just want to, as we go out, what does this do to the collective soul? When so many of us just sit around and watch this genocide, we see two-year-olds being shot in the street by money paid for, we paying for with our tax dollars. What does this do to a culture? What does this mean? Do we all become a little bit less?
Well, I think it's called moral trauma at the outer limits. People feel that their names have been abused. Devastating viciousness and cruelty has been used in the names of the American people. That's why a lot of the signs say in the demonstrations, not in our name. I think a lot of it turns into moral numbness. They get numb, just like they're numb to sending migrants who've committed no crimes to Trump alligator Alcatraz. We should put the Trump brand name, Trump Tornado, Trump Guadalupe Flood, anything that results from not being ready, cutting back on FEMA, not having weather forecasting adequate, and there's devastation, we should give Trump's brand name, you know, the Trump Hurricane, Trump Wildfires. But we got to renew our moral refinement as a civilization here. I'm so upset that organized religion hasn't spoken out again. We should hear from the cardinals, the bishops, the reverends, the priests more forcefully. They've been too silent. They've been too frightened. They're supposed to be the moral custodians of our norms that bind our society together and undergird the rule of law. He's ruined that. Trump has ruined that. I think all the demonstrations, just to conclude, should focus on "you're fired" to Trump in order to lay the basis for impeachment. Impeachment is the only tool left, and believe me, it's not pie in the sky. You will see. Just the way with Nixon, with far less transgressions. He won 49 states in 1972, 60% in the polls. Within less than 2 years, he was told, "You're fired," and he resigned before he was impeached and removed from office. So that's one phrase that Trump understands. He's firing hundreds of thousands of dedicated civil servants and contractors, etc. And, you know, he uses a lot of epithets. He accuses people of being deranged, wacko, lunatic, crazy, crooked, loser, criminal, corrupt. Called Mangdami a communist lunatic the other day. But the one phrase he knows is "you're fired." And all the grievances people have around the country should coalesce into one resounding power: "you're fired." And our legal profession has got to wake up. Where are the bar associations? They're supposed to be the first responders against the crashing of the rule of law and the violation of the Constitution. So So it's up to people as ordinary citizens. We're back to civic self-respect, Dennis. Do not underestimate your impact. The Constitution starts we the people. It doesn't start we the corporations or we the Congress.
That's
it doesn't
right.
even mention company or corporation.
Yes.
Have a higher
yes.
estimate of your own significance. Spread the word in your neighborhood, and you'll achieve what our forebears achieved when they faced overwhelming odds and refused to give up on themselves.
Thank you. That's the voice of Ralph Nader. Ralph Nader, really my hero, and we appreciate you taking the time out to be with us. Please come back and let's continue this dialogue. What an honor to have you with us today, Ralph. Please take care. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Thank you, Dennis, and listeners, support KPFA. You don't
thank
get
you.
This kind of interview on CBS or ABC or even NPR.
You.
Support
thank
KPFA.
Thank you. Thank you, Ralph. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back, and we've got some important business to talk to you about, so stay with us. Joining us is a co-founder of the American Indian Movement and the International Indian Treaty Council, Mr. William Means. He's going to be speaking out on turning Alcatraz back into a maximum security prison. Well, welcome, Miguel. Mr. Means, it's good to have you back. But these are terrible times, and they're going after the center, what's become a key part of celebrating the indigenous communities in North America and in Northern California. Trump is here, and he wants to shut down Alcatraz. Your thoughts?
This is Bill Means, and I welcome each and every listener to KPFA as well, and urge you to talk to some of the DJs here and get in on the fun drive whenever they have that. They usually have it. Maybe it's on now, but anyway, I just want to encourage listeners. It's always good to be here in the Bay Area, which is many of the places that have relit the flame of indigenous people's resistance and been the site of many, many sacred ceremonies, which is kind of a slap in the face to this whole Alcatraz idea. Well, they must go to bed thinking of ways to upset or desecrate Indian peoples. Because, you know, we have some of our first Indian people that were ever housed there were Hopi Indians because they refused to accept Christianity. So then we went from that, we thought we were getting better. We went to freedom of religion talking of, we had an act in 1978 that was passed. So we've done a lot of organizing. But the thing about it is Alcatraz has become a very sacred place. I don't know if any of you have been there for the sunrise ceremony in which many, many different faiths and denominations come together there to talk to the Tocachlas, to talk to the Great Spirit, to talk to the Great Mystery. And as such, it's a place everybody gathers on Thanksgiving. We don't hardly make any posters or try to advertise too much. If the budget's not there, we just move ahead with the celebration. And that's how sacred it's become, is that we'll have as many, especially on Thanksgiving Day, because we branded Thanksgiving as a national day of mourning for Indian peoples way back in 1979. So that's when they first came to Alcatraz and became part of the great movement that kind of lit the flame, as I said, of Indian, indigenous, and people's resistance. But we have all faith, and I think I covered that part, but here you can see the largest lawsuit in history of if this keeps going, because almost everybody knows about Alcatraz spiritual celebration on Thanksgiving. People automatically mark it on their calendar. I know I do. I try to make it every year. Sometimes I can, sometimes I can't. But if I'm in the area or possibly get there, it's like an obligation. It's like a spiritual rope that you're tied to, not only the prayers and the tree, but the history of our Indian people being incarcerated there. And so with all this idea of turning it into a prison, it's a total desecration and disrespect for indigenous people. And not only us, but other peoples have come to be with us every Thanksgiving. So I'll just say that much for now and let Gavilan and others speak on the issue. But it's a very, very important sacred place, and we're not going to stand for Trump or Bureau of Prisons or whoever it is, Homeland Security, to illegally occupy. I mean, 1871, they stole the Black Hills. Hello, go ahead.
I know, Bill, that you all have sort of renamed it Un-Thanksgiving, and anybody who's been there, and thousands go every Un-Thanksgiving to remember the genocide that was committed by the U.S. and to make sure that it never happens again. People, this is about remembering in the celebration of what happened so it never happens again, yes?
Oh, yes, sir. It's just like building a prison in the middle of the sacred grounds of Jewish people in Germany, where they buried so many of their relatives. Now, we have had people that have been that have died there, and of course they usually ship them back to their reservation. But it's one of those things that when Thanksgiving's coming, everybody's heading towards San Francisco. Beautiful place.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Bill. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's Mr. Bill Means. He is one of the founders of the American Indian Movement and the International Indian Treaty Council. Knows more about broken treaties and the United States than probably anybody in this world. And also joining us is your friend, Bill, Miguel Gavilan Molina. Gavilan.
Well, it's always good to hear your voice, Bill, you know, strong and giving us guidance.
Yeah.
You know, sharing your view, and you're absolutely correct. You know, Alcatraz was built, and at first, the first inmates, you know, were the resistance that was happening in the Southwest, you know, in Arizona, New Mexico, where the people there were rounded up. And as you said, because they refused to acknowledge the Christian cross and cut their hair, they were the first occupants. And finally, in the 60s, it was closed down because it was decaying. It was going to cost too much to maintain it, rebuild it, renovate it. And they closed it down. And from then, you know, back in 1969 with Richard Oakes and some students from the University of San Francisco at Berkeley, you know, they went out there in the middle of the night. And when Richard Oakes took that leap, it was so incredibly symbolic and almost dreamlike, because with that leap into the water, freezing water, and then making it to the banks and crawling up there, it started the occupation of Alcatraz, and it brought world attention. All of a sudden, Indians that had been, you know, we'd been regulated to Western movies, you know, John Wayne killing Indians all during the 50s and 60s. All of a sudden, Native Americans came out of the past into the present, and the occupation of Alcatraz, you know, started in 69, lasted into 1970. I think it was 18 months. And from then, it became a sacred site. It was a sacred site before that, before the Spanish, before all those different Euro colonial groups. You know, the Ohlone people and the Miwoks, and I believe sometimes the Pomos would go out to that rock to do ceremony. So back in 69, with the reoccupation of Alcatraz by indigenous peoples, it once again returned to be a sacred site, a site where so much suffering, loneliness, isolation, torture, and even execution happened at that place. And for the past 50-plus years, it has been a sacred site, as you say, Bill, where all four directions come together, all four colors. There's Pacific Island people that come. There's people that come from South America, from Mexico. People come from Canada. People come from all corners of the United States territories. And we even have sometimes the privilege to receive, Buddhist monks that are coming from across the Pacific Ocean, you know, to pay respect and honor. So it all happens. So it has become a magnet, you know, where all faiths, all people of different religions, different colors, different ethnic backgrounds, indigenous people come together. We've celebrated, you know, the Palestinians. We've celebrated their struggles. I mean, so every year, all these different groups come together. It's a magnet. And I understand the politics where the mayor of San Francisco, along with other people, view Alcatraz as a big moneymaker, a big tourist attraction. And it just might be the biggest tourist attraction for San Francisco. And it's kind of twisted for me mentality, really a place, formerly a place of pain and suffering and loneliness and executions is, you know, everybody wants to see it. It's kind of unreal. But that said, you know, it is had become amongst all indigenous nations, you know, all across the Americas as a magnet where everybody gathers on Indigenous Peoples Day, October 12th, and also the big one where thousands come out. I know that the ships, the boats sell out, you know, to the Thanksgiving, a day of mourning, but also a day of celebration for our survival. So, Bill, there are these talks, of converting, you know, Alcatraz, a sacred site, you know, back into a place of punishment and suffering. What can people do? How can people push back against that?
Well, one of the things I love about the Bay Area, the whole region there, and indeed California, they've been at the front end of the indigenous people's struggle for decades. It lead in Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta and all these former leaders that weren't afraid to stand up against the police or, in this case, it's ICE. So we even stood up against ICE to confront them. But they didn't even exist till, well, maybe since Trump got in, I guess. But we have a history of our people being there, but honoring it. It doesn't take an act of Congress to be on our side, we got an opportunity there in the Bay Area with all the organizations that's going on of all races fighting for the rights, especially this time of, like I said, ICE, the denial of rights, of basic human rights to our indigenous people. And all colors, they even taking them out of churches sometimes, or they go to where churches feed the people, and they go there and round them up, just like rounding up cattle or something. So we go from a very dehumanizing place like Alcatraz to the fact that our people are still resisting. And it's a good place to organize in the Bay Area because they have such a history of being involved in indigenous people's struggles and human rights and marches. And right now you see on TV almost every night the tear gas that's floating in the air down in Los Angeles where the people are resisting these illegal roundups and resisting the policies of the new administration. So I just want to thank the people of San Francisco as well, because they've always been receptive to what we're trying to do as American Indian Movement. And so we'll be there again this year, November, if I could possibly get out this hospital. I'm saying that in a joking way, but I'm serious. If I could possibly get there, I'll be there, because that's how important it is to show the support, the solidarity with indigenous peoples, but also the whole history and culture of indigenous people and their resistance, their organizing. Many of it starts there, right there in the Bay Area. So we appreciate those people, listeners of KPFA, who packed the boats and Well, I said, we've never had less than, I think maybe after we started, about maybe 4 or 5 years. So I give credit to a man by the name of Bill Wapapa, who was one of the most recent leaders in the Bay Area of various causes to support indigenous people, farm workers, bring everybody together. And we go there every day on Thanksgiving. We always had at least 5,000 people. I mean, we can't get no more people on the boats. We can't get no more boats. They limit us to using one company. So anyway, we've even worked out a part of the income would come to several Bay Area organizations, mainly International Indian Treaty Council. We don't pay. You only have to pay the park service. So we split up the money of that day, Indigenous Peoples Day, as it's known there in the Bay Area. So I really want to thank the people of the Bay Area for keeping this movement alive and putting some more juice into it here. Every time Trump makes a bad move to deny human rights or deny our legal rights, AIM or other Bay Area organizations step in there and show resistance publicly. They're not afraid to get arrested. So we thank all those various people who've been killed in the struggle or came to Alcatraz, many just to find themselves or to find a new way of relating to the movements that are out there. So thank you very much.
Bill, oftentimes,
yes,
when we go to the island, we recognize the plight and the struggle of the Palestinian people. Could you talk a little bit about it's sort of a parallel structure of the Native Americans and the Palestinians are sort of fighting one struggle, aren't they?
Well, they sure are, because I remember the first time we took a delegation to the United Nations to Beirut, Lebanon, to attend a human rights conference. It was Yasser Arafat just to say his name in that region brings international solidarity. But I do want to say what he said, and this was a little quote. He said, "We are the Palestinians, and the Palestinians are we." He said at a big, massive rally there in Beirut back in probably in 1970s. So thank you very much, and I appreciate all the solidarity. It ain't over. It's just getting started. So let's make a show of force, sir, on Thanksgiving Day for un-Thanksgiving. Well, thank you very much. Excuse me.
No problem, Bill. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Gavilan and I and the whole community here in the Bay Area appreciate your presence and the decades of work in the liberation of Alcatraz. And obviously, we're going to be locking arms again to continue the celebration and to make sure that Alcatraz is the people's place to go and celebrate life, not a prison to celebrate death. Thanks, Bill, and we hope we can talk to you soon, and we hope maybe you can make it out to Alcatraz for the next Thanksgiving.
All right.
That does it for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Our theme music is written and produced by Charlie Lang. For questions, comments, email Dennis Bernstein at dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Here we go again, it's the game we love.
Play game.
Tune in on the first and third Tuesday of the month at 11 a.m. for Winner's Bias, a new show exploring the culture around tabletop gaming. From game nights to